the seven seals, so Revelation chapter 6. We're going to read the first eight verses. That's where we're going to kind of be focused. But we're actually only going to really focus on the first two verses in the context of the eight, because there's a lot of foreground that I want to lay down as we go into this journey, which is going to be Revelation chapter 6 all the way into chapter 11, 12, 13, even 14. So it goes a good ways into Revelation, and hopefully as we lay this out, you'll kind of get a grasp of what I'm talking about there. So I'm going to read the first eight verses, Revelation chapter 6. "Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, 'Come.' And out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another. And he was given a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and its rider had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard what seemed to be a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, 'A quart of wheat for a denarius, three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine.' And when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, 'Come.' And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and its rider's name was Death, and Hades followed him. And they were given authority over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword and with famine and with pestilence and by wild beasts of the earth." So, Revelation chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Right? Everybody heard that term, the four horsemen, the four horsemen? Not just a Metallica song from the 80s? What do you need help?
Yeah.
Well, come here. Bring it here. I can't.
Yeah.
It's at the very end. Well, you were at Romans. You weren't too far off. Revelation. Let's go.
Yeah.
Here you go. Revelation.
Oh.
Chapter 6. Go to 6. Huh? All right. Excuse me. So, how many of you have heard Four Horsemen? What is your idea? If they're preconceived notions, if you don't know, this is just what I've heard. What do you understand, or what have you heard about the Four Horsemen? The pale horse is Death. Yep. That's definitely one of them. How many of you have seen the movie Tombstone? Kurt Russell. He's in the OK Corral, the shootout at the OK Corral. He's Pat Garrett. I think he's going after, the bad guys. And, he gets out there and shouts, you tell them I'm coming and hell's coming with me. But he's on a pale horse, and he's given an allusion, to this principle that upon a pale horse, of course, comes death and the sword and judgment. And that's the reference there. So you oftentimes hear this reference to the pale horse or the rider on the pale horse bringing, swift judgment and death and things of that nature. What else? What about kids? Like, have y'all ever heard somebody make the comment about the four horsemen or the end times with the four horsemen? So this is all new to y'all. All right. Well, good. So there's four of y'all. So the four of you, come on up here. Right. Yeah, that's good. That's right. Hal Lindsey. All right. So who wants to be the white horse?
I guess
Preston, you moved. So Preston, you're the white horse. What about the red horse? All right, there you go. He moved. Red horse. Who wants to be the black horse?
They're not moving.
All right, I saw your finger. Yeah, it's a black horse. So, Michaela is the pale horse. You bring death and Hades. All right, so who's the white horse? All right, you're pretty much the focus today. All right, so we got the four horses. What color are you? Red, black, pale. All right, y'all can sit down. Remember your spots, you know, so over the next like 6 months, you'll be having a part, you know, a role in the teaching. So the white horse, Preston. Preston's the white horse. This is what we're going to focus on today, particularly the first two verses. But we need to lay some foundation here to kind of understand this. And number one, we have to start with a reminder of what types of literature do we see in the Bible as a whole? Does anybody know the classifications of the types of literature that we find in the Bible?
Like poetry?
Poetry is one, right? What are books of poetry in the Bible? Psalms, right? So that's one, poetry. What else? Books of wisdom, right? Books of wisdom. So like Ecclesiastes, Proverbs. The law, but it's not a genre, right? It's not a genre. It's narratives, right? So we have narratives. What are narratives? Narratives, right? Yeah. They're stories. That's exactly right. They're stories. You know, a narrative is a story, but it's typically a story that's an accurate historical account of something, right? So if I'm giving you a narrative, like if I'm explaining something to you in written terms, that's a narrative. You know, of how things started, how things went along, how things ended. Now, as we look at Revelation, is it narrative, wisdom, or poetry? Poetry is not poetry.
It's none of the three.
We've defined the classification. The classification is literally in the title of the book. Do you remember what's the title of the book? Revelation. Revelation in Greek is apocalypsis, right? So it's apocalyptic, right? It apocalyptic literature is a genre, right? This is apocalyptic literature.
I know that. I don't mean to interrupt, but I know that one for me, especially, it's a hindrance to understand the book because we don't. The people to whom it was written were familiar with that genre.
Yes.
We don't use that genre.
This is abstract to something that we understand today.
Exactly.
Last night over dinner, Christian and I had dinner with some friends, and we were having a conversation about other countries outside of the United States. Particularly, we were talking about the Middle East, the Emirates, Dubai, because I've been to Dubai, and we were talking about, you know, like our friend, the wife, she couldn't wrap her head around the lifestyle of being and living in Dubai. She's like, that makes absolutely no sense to me. I'm like, because you've never been there. You're not from there, right? And you're not there. You're not from there. It doesn't make any sense to you. Us as Americans living in America, we have a very narrow view because we know what we see and understand. It gets a little broader because of the internet, you know, the news, television. We can now see and read and have a lot more interaction globally. But it's still not the same thing as when you live in another country or you go to another country. You know, we have a perspective of, well, this is the way life is. And then you go somewhere else and you're like, hey, where do I get Starbucks? And they're like, what is that? Well, where do I get coffee? Well, you grow it and then you dry it and then you grind it and you make your own. Well, what if I don't have a coffee bush? Well, you can pay that guy for some of his until you get yours established. But if you don't establish your own, like, you're out. You know, or, you know, me in the Philippines, the first trip over there to see Brother Barry, and we hit Mindanao, and we're driving down this road headed, you know, to Cagayan from the airport, and there's this 90-year-old woman hunched over you know, sweeping the road. And I'm like, you would never, I mean, I want you to think about around anywhere in the United States, where would you see a 90 to 95 year old woman out sweeping the road? And not, and I'm not talking about just like tidying up her drive. You, this is obvious she's doing this to try to get money. Where in the world, where in the United States would you ever see such a thing? You won't. People, I mean, ask Anthony. People literally will live on a street corner in a homeless situation, and even then, somehow, some way, people will come and give them things. That is foreign, right? And everywhere else in the world. And to Bruce's point, that's very similar to how we look at genre, how we look at this category of apocalyptic language and writings, and why we have to be very, very careful with how we interpret this. Because if you just approach it from the mindset of it's just like everything else,
narrative.
Yeah, like narrative, yeah. You're in trouble, right? Because now you got, you know, 12-headed dragons running around. You got, I mean, you got, you know, the
that's
lamb has
exactly what yeah. the people who promote pre-trib dispensationalism do. They interpret it.
I'm going to talk about that
as if it were narrative, and that's a great mistake.
Yeah.
Revelation is a real problem for me. I have a real difficult time with Revelation personally, and that's why.
I used to as well. I still. It's not like 100% comfort zone here, right? There's still things that I think that we, just for the simple nature of what we're getting, we don't fully comprehend or fully understand, and that's okay. But I still think that it is, God has provided it in a way that we should be able to get value from this book and have an understanding of what God's intention is for this book, not approaching it with going, you know, like we talked about in the very beginning. People look at Revelation, they're like, "Whoa, time out!" Like, I don't deal with that.
For some of us, there's a lot of stuff that has to be erased.
Yeah.
I mean, but you know, they could come with these big banners with all the everything written out, and then the next guy would come with a great big banner stretched from. And
you got all the charts.
Yeah, right. The charts.
Yeah.
And it's all different, and you can't memorize all.
No.
Nah. It's just over
nah.
my head.
But and that's what you know. I hope to bring.
Here, I think you and I are probably one of the well, and Sonny and Nathan are the ones that have been affected by that. But I don't think younger people have.
No,
because
I
it hasn't. Eschatology has not been on the forefront unless you run into.
No. And I think eschatology, for those that don't, who knows what eschatology is? Raise your hand. Right, if you don't know, eschatology is basically the study of end times. Eschatos means the end, right? And so it's the study of end times. So when you hear somebody say, "What's your eschatology?" what they're asking is, "What do you believe about the end times? Like, how's this all going to play out? What's the end?" Right? That's eschatology. I've done a study here on eschatology. We talked about the major views, right? So
yeah.
Pastor Bruce just mentioned pre-trib dispensationalism, right? So we talked about what does dispensationalists believe, you know, what are post-millennials, what are amillennials, you know, what are historic pre-mills. We went through a lot of this stuff, so I don't want to hash that. Those terms will come out, and as they do come out as we study Revelation, I will explain them, right? So you won't be in the dark when we get to those terms. But that's exactly right. People look at Revelation as being an end times thing. And because it's perceived to be an end times thing, people don't understand it. They don't study it. They don't deal with it. They just say, "Oh, well, it's out there." Well, there have been some people who have picked it up and ran with it. And I think done so in serious error. And as a result, as Becky said, has introduced great confusion. Into the church because they show it in a very convincing way. I mean, they put up these elaborate charts. They put up these big banners that has this flow of how everything's playing out over time. My prayer is that we'll look at this and you will begin to see this is not as complicated as people make it out to be. Because once you, this is, from my purview, this is much like Romanism, Roman Catholics. And how many of you have seen Catholics and they'll repeat things from Scripture, but they'll do it in Latin? back in the day, if you rewind back to the Dark Ages, right? So if you go rewind the clock back to the 13, 1400s, the medieval times, you had the priests that would constantly do things in Latin, and you and I, common people, could not read the scriptures because everything was, you know, was in Latin, and nobody was educated, and nobody could read Latin. And it wasn't until, you know, the scriptures, Martin Luther, John Calvin, and others began to do some works to translate writings into German, and then from German, eventually we get to English, and people died for that, right? So that you and I could have a reading of the text, a reading of the scriptures. But prior to that, it was one group of people promoting it in a way and saying, we're the gatekeeper, right? So you've got to come to me because I hold all the source of information. And so what happens is you have people in modern day that take Revelation and they create this complex schema. And then they present that, and then you look at it and go, okay, yeah, this is way over my head. And they go, that's right, that's why you need me, right? Well, I want to tell you that you can read this and you can understand this. And it's not as complicated as people make it out to be. And that's...
Can I make a qualifying statement for that?
Josie, stop. That's got to be her.
Can I make a qualifying?
Yes, please.
Amen that sentiment 100%. Two things. One is, it can be, we have realized that back in the day when Jerome did the Latin, and then the Roman Catholicism developed this whole system of sacraments that, you know, were necessary for salvation, et cetera, et cetera. The Vulgate, the Latin translation of the Bible, became, in a lot of ways, viewed the same way that we have today. We have people who hold
King James only.
King James only.
Yeah.
And it is a very, very similar scenario. That's the one thing. And then the other is that it is you're absolutely right about the way that eschatology is used to kind of set up a platform to really promote oneself, because they aren't. However, that being said, not everybody who holds to one particular, especially we're looking at pre-trib dispensationalism, uses that in a way. So we got a lot of people, like John MacArthur is a good example, that holds to pre-trib dispensationalism.
Yeah.
And he does it in a way that is not problematic at all for me. But having said that, there's a whole website. I found a website several years ago where it basically gave you, they vetted different people in ministry based on their eschatology.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those people that they vetted were flat out heretics.
Yeah.
They believed in pre-trib dispensationalism, and they promoted that. Therefore, that became the litmus test for whether they were orthodox.
Yeah. What do you believe? How's it going to play out? So.
It's exactly. Ignoring everything else that they believe.
Ignore the fact that they said that you can become a god.
Yeah.
Exactly. Ignore that fact.
Yeah.
But
name it, claim it,
but
whatever.
They believe Israel's going to retake everything, you know, and then, okay, well, so they're valid.
They're good to go.
Yeah.
Which is what you want to avoid.
Yeah, we do. So, but, you know, all of that said, is that as we go through here, and this is why I told you I wanted to get started, because, you know, 9:45 is when we start, only get an hour, you know, to go through this. But no, that's why I was saying, and everybody was in the back hanging out. I'm like, hey, look, I need to get started, because there's a lot of pre-ground before we can actually get into the text. And then when we get into the text, we're only going to look at two verses. And even this is going to take me, you know, at least an hour. So I want to, you know, I want to lay this foreground, because it's important to how you move forward with understanding Revelation as a book, particularly that what type of literature is Revelation? What type? Apocalyptic, right? Apocalyptic. Because it is apocalyptic literature, we can't just read it like we read everything else. We have to put on the glasses, the lenses of, you know, of interpretation, to say, okay, this is apocalyptic literature. I don't just read it and take it at face value. When we began the study of Revelation, I laid out apocalyptic literature is not intended to be taken literally. It is full of symbolism, of shadows and types and different things that are happening. However, those types, shadows, and characterizations do have a back-end literal meaning, but we just don't take the symbols, you know, up front literally. We have a lot of symbolism, a lot of representation here that we have to deal with. So the word revelation, Greek word, apocalypsis, is where we get the word apocalypse. So this is, you know, this is not, oh, it's the apocalypse. You've been conditioned, most people, so White Horse. I feel like I've given you an Indian name. Right? But so, you know, White Horse, have you heard of the word apocalypse? What goes through your head? What are you, you're 13? So as a 13-year-old, what goes through your mind when you hear the word apocalypse? What does that mean? Zombies? What about rest of the, you know, if you're under 20, what goes through your head? I know I'm on the border, you know, with, so let's go to 22. How about that? So it can reel all into the category, right? And what goes through when you hear, so for young people, when you hear apocalypse, what do you think about? Chaos, destruction, zombies, survival of the fittest, yes, survival scenarios.
All I'm saying is you gotta stop.
Yeah, it's gonna be bad. But that, see, that's. Yeah, well, that's a movie.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, nobody in this room besides you and I. How many of you have ever seen the movie? Sonny probably has. Apocalypse Now.
You don't remember? I'm the only one.
I've heard of it.
I can't believe it.
Have I seen it? Yeah, that's a war classic. Yeah, it's a war classic. Yeah. Bum, 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 bum. The helicopters come over and start lighting everything up. Yeah. Yes. Anyway. Yeah, but it's a. You know, it's chaos, it's mass destruction, you know, that's what's going on. So, but we have this notion that apocalypse is four horsemen. Destruction, you know, is being unleashed, you know, all of this stuff. And the Greek word for revelation is apocalypse. But, you know, what do we say that means? What does revelation mean? To reveal, to bring clarity. Now, specifically, we're dealing with revelation or revealing of what God is saying is going to eventually happen. You know, John is getting a revelation of God telling him, you know, in the context broad, church, you're under dire persecution. John chapter 1, Revelation 1, 9, John says, I'm a partner with you, talking to the churches, I'm a partner with you, seven churches of Asia, in the great tribulation, in the tribulation, right? Remember that? So John has told them, I'm a partner with you in the tribulation. Seven churches of Asia, you're in the tribulation. You're going through this great trial. There's all of this persecution. There's all of this stuff. We're going to talk about some more of this. But all of this is going on. And at the end of the day, Revelation, God shows John through these elaborate visions, God wins. Christ wins. Christ is on the throne. Church, you will be victorious regardless of what you go through on this earth. That's it culminated, right? So it's the revealing of the revelation. Does that involve end times? Yes, because in the end, we win. So it is a revealing of end times understanding of things that are yet to happen and things that are yet to come. But simultaneously, we have to approach this with the understanding that this is really a letter meant to encourage the church that it doesn't matter the state of your persecution or what you're going through. Yes, it may be difficult. Yes, it may be painful. Yes, it may be hard. But keep your eyes upon heaven. Keep your eyes upon Christ, regardless of what you go through in life. Amen? All right. So that's the word revelation, apocalyptic literature we've talking about. This is highly, highly symbolic. These symbols are not, you know, to be taken literally. Symbols are to be interpreted through the eyes of the author. So when John says he sees four horses, you know, and people go, there's going to be four horses in the air. You're going to look out in your driveway one day and you're going to see the pale horse, you know, with the guy with the hood with the sickle, you know, riding around out there killing people. No, no, you know, that's not what we're talking about. But that's where some people, they take this and they tell, well, there's going to be a war and this war is going to be in a certain place and you're going to have, you know, what's the final war?
Armageddon.
And there's the Megiddo Valley in Israel, and they're going to gather around Megiddo and the Megiddo Valley, and they're going to establish this battle, and you're going to have these horses there, and blood's going to flow up to the bridles of the horse. Like, this is symbolic language, right? Okay, understand that. And it has to be interpreted through the lens of John, right? John is a Jew, right? John has a Jewish perspective. John has a Jewish understanding. How many of you know that there are four horses of the same colors referenced in Zechariah? Okay, if you didn't, there are. So wouldn't it make sense that John, being a Jew, would have a clear understanding of the prophecies of Zechariah that make reference to four horses of the same colors? So perhaps we need to look back at Zechariah and say, okay, what did John understand when he saw four horses of these colors? Right? But things like that. Let the Scriptures interpret the Scriptures. Don't come up with some elaborate thing that only you know and that only you understand and then try to pass that off of that as valid. Right? That's wrong. Right? We have to interpret the book through the eyes of John with this intimate Old Testament understanding. Also, not only does John have an intimate understanding of the Old Testament, what time period is this happening in? First century, right? Who rules the world in the first century? Rome, right? Does anybody know specifically about 30 years after Jesus dies, buried, resurrected, ascended, about 30 years later, what happens in Rome?
In Rome, specifically, in
64 A.D., to be exact. 64 A.D. in Rome. Does anybody know what happens from a historical perspective? You do. You probably just don't realize you do. The great fires of Rome. Rome burns. Rome burns to the ground. It's like the fire lasts like 8 days or something. It's catastrophic. You know, hundreds and hundreds of people die in this fire. Yeah, who caused the fire? Who caused the fire? Well, it's who exactly started the fire is probably up for debate. Some say actually Nero and some things that were going on actually caused the fire. But Nero needed a scapegoat. And so guess who gets the blame? The Christians. Why do the Christians get the blame? Why does Nero hate the Christians? What do Romans believe about gods?
They were atheists. They called them atheists.
Yeah. Well, they called the Christians atheists. They were polytheists. What does that mean? There are many gods, right? All kind of gods. Remember when Paul, you know, goes to Mars Hill, particularly in Greece, but he's there and they got all of these statues and they got one to the unknown because they didn't want to leave one out, right? And so Paul says, let me tell you about the one, the unknown. Let me tell you about the one that you don't know. Right? He's the God of gods, right? And he gives this discourse. But Rome, specifically, you know, Nero in 64 AD, Rome burns. Nero blames the Christians because they hate the Christians because the Christians are rejecting polytheism. They're rejecting that all of these other gods are valid. There is only one God. If you remember when I was preaching through Revelation in the beginning to the seven churches, particularly a couple of these churches suffered great persecution. The ability to buy and sell got seriously restricted. Does anybody remember why when I talked about that? Remember the trade guilds, the sellers, basically the unions of the day? Right, you remember great as Artemis of the Ephesians? You remember that conversation? You know, where all of a sudden you're rejecting the gods, and if you were a metal worker and you were a Christian, did you go out and continue to create sculptures of Artemis and sell them as this is a valid god? No, that was the problem. Is you as a Christian, you couldn't promote, buy or sell false gods. You know, well, then everybody's looking at you going, "What? Wait a minute, what's wrong with you? Now, wait a minute, you're saying that my livelihood is invalid? Well, guess what? Now everybody hates you, and you're on the outs. Well, guess what? You come into the marketplace, and it's like, hey, I'm coming in to buy a steak. Oh, it's a steak sacrificed to an idol, buddy. Closing the curtain on you. You can't buy it. You know, and so they get to be little smart alecks. And not only that, but it's getting very restrictive for the Christians in Rome because of all of these challenges of saying, we're not supporting, you know, polytheism. We believe there is one God, you know, and that became a challenge, you know, for a lot of the Christians.
The other thing, I agree 100% with what you're saying, is stuff, but there's another aspect of it that because they would not burn a pinch of incense to Caesar.
We're going to get there. We're going to get there. You know, that, see you got to recognize that the emperors of Rome, eventually, now keep in mind, 64 AD, this is Nero. Nero is aggravated by the Christians. Begins to say that they're the responsibility for burning Rome because they hate Rome. They're against Rome. They don't believe in the gods of Rome. They don't support the things that Rome, you know, stands for. Therefore, they're rebelling, and we need to stamp them out. They caused a great fire. You want to cause a fire? I'll set you on fire in my gardens. Right? We see Christians being impaled, placed into the garden on spikes, a body hanging on a spike, dousing them with oil and lighting them on fire as kind of a punishment and a retribution to say, you burn our city, I burn you. Right? This great, great, this is in 64. Now we've got to fast forward to, you know, somewhere in the 90s, probably 93 to 95 AD is where Revelation is now being written. John is exiled on Patmos. He's under the imprisonment of Rome, right? So he's now under the imprisonment of Rome. And one of the things that had happened from 64 up until 95, matter of fact, in 64, Nero eventually, he's about 30 years old, he commits suicide. He kills himself. But there was a rumor and a pagan prophecy that Nero, whenever he died, he would be resurrected, that he would rise to power again. Well, that sets off a speculation that, well, Nero didn't really die. He's in hiding somewhere. He's going to come back. You know, or, you know, if he does come back, he's going to be all-powerful, and he's proving deity. Now, this goes into Bruce's point. So right around Nero, up until 95, you had this growing, continual mindset within Rome that the emperor, the Caesar, is a god, that he is deified, because he's growing to have this understanding from the people that he's higher than everybody else. He has this special capability. If you kill him, he just comes back as somebody else, right? And this kind of plays out. So now once you get into the 90s, you know, you've got the Christian persecution growing even more because, you know, if you come into Rome, you were providing offerings to the Caesar, offerings to God, whether it's burning incense, maybe a monetary contribution. There were different ways to do things. And the Christians were like, I can't make an offering to a false god. Well, now you're on the outs again. Right? So even from the persecution they endured under Nero, which was horrendous, it just continually got worse for them through the whole Roman Empire because they would not and could not recognize Caesar as God. And they ruled the world.
Do you remember the name of the document that you got for burning the incense? Do you remember that allowed you?
No.
I can't remember.
I don't.
It's significant, though. And I think it's significant because if you understand that dynamic of what was going on, I think it gives you great insight into seeing what's actually going on in our society right now before very long.
Yeah, which is exactly why I tell you this is not just a first century document. Revelation is not just, it does give us clarity in our day and age, not necessarily from, that's exactly what's happening right now. But that's a falsehood. Yeah, that's a falsehood. When somebody says, you know, Revelation said there's going to be wars and rumors of wars. Well, they've been wars since Genesis, right? So, I mean, like, that's irrelevant. But the fact of the matter is the Christian being focused on the worship of one God alone, and then being persecuted by the world because you don't adopt a pagan system or a worldly system, that exists today, right? And it carries over today.
Yeah,
so
I didn't mean by saying, oh, you see prophecy being worked out in front of our eyes.
No, I know that's not what you meant.
No, it's not what I meant at all. What I meant is that the dynamic is the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you turn, they demanded that you have allegiance to the state as God.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing the same thing play out right now.
Yeah. I mean, look at the state of the United States with, if you don't adopt the position of the government, support the killing of babies, so, I mean, on and on and on, you're on the outs. You're wrong. You're morally wrong. You're conceptually wrong to the point to where perhaps eventually we take away your exemption status as a church. We take away your right to say these things. You can no longer preach this word or teach this word because it's against the state. Remember a few weeks ago, I quoted to you a legal, you know, case in Britain where this is playing out, right? So, yeah, that's
listen to the Democratic presidential candidates now. Listen to what they're saying.
Yeah.
If I'm elected, I will take your right to worship the true and living God away. That's exactly
in essence, yeah. So, we've got to interpret this book.
No, they don't say that in those words.
But that's what they're saying.
Exactly what they're the policy that they would institute is that's exactly what they intended to do.
Yeah.
And for the very same reason, they want you to worship the state above all other gods.
The state is the top.
Gods,
yeah.
You know, but you got to be a polytheist, and the state has to be the supreme god.
Which is Rome.
Right.
Which is why I think in a lot of cases, even some of my own understanding, when you look at who is the Antichrist, and that I think that's Rome to an extent. It goes way beyond that, but you see that spirit of Antichrist was there then, it always has been, and it's there now, and this will play out as we progress through the next 15 minutes and I somehow get through 17 more pages of notes. Yeah, we'll make it. So, Revelation is, you know, three key points here. It's apocalyptic in its genre, right? So we got to understand that. Apocalyptic literature uses symbols. You have to understand that. Symbols have to be interpreted through the eyes of the author. Not, you don't get to just sit down and go, well, I think this means this. You don't get that privilege. You have to look and say, okay, well, what would John have understood? Look at his history. Look at his background. Look at what's going on, right? So we take his Jewish culture into perspective. We take the Old Testament text into perspective. And we also have to take what's going on in that time and day with Rome in perspective, right? And then third, Revelation is also prophetic in its nature. Certain future events are foretold in advance. These things are true. But what we see in Revelation is the Lord granting the churches a clear understanding of God's authority and Christ's supremacy, regardless of human circumstance. And we would do well to take note and learn from this. With all that's going on in this time period, the Christian church needed a reminder. I mean, imagine the state in which they're living. God's abandoned us. Christ said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And yet, I just watched my husband and my children be impaled and lit on fire. Like, Jesus, where are you? And then now, you know, how many of you heard the term out of sight, out of mind? What does that mean? That's it. You don't see it, you don't think about it. You know, so now, think about this, you know, and actually Scripture actually addresses this. There were false prophets who debated with Peter and said, you know, when's your Jesus coming back, basically? It's, you know, it's been years and years and years and he's not come back. Well, now it's been thousands of years and he's not come back. So now everybody looks at you and goes, you're an idiot. Why do you believe this stuff? It's been thousands of years. You know, your quote-unquote Jesus has not returned. He's not going to return. This is all a myth. This is all made up. And John is addressing the churches saying, Don't get caught up in what's said or what's going on. This is what you need to know, and this is what you need to understand. And he's giving them, God is giving them a realization of what's going to happen and what's going to play out. And this is the reality. You know, we've been setting a baseline through Revelation that demonstrates the book had an immediate purpose for the seven churches of Asia. But also, this book is not and should not be understood as strictly 100% future facing. There's some people who view that. Well, we can't really understand anything. This is all future stuff. No. Then you're telling me that it had no purpose for the seven churches? No, it had a purpose for the seven churches. That's who it was written to. Right? So it had a purpose. Right? The Apostle John should never be mistaken for Nostradamus. Now, this is probably another one that young people... How many of you have heard of Nostradamus? Raise your hand. Heard of him? How many of you have not heard of Nostradamus? All right, white horse, red horse, black horse, pale horse? Right, pale horse, no. Not heard of Nostradamus. So Nostradamus was claimed to fame. He's a Frenchman. He's a French guy. And the Latin version of his name translated to Nostradamus, because that's a Latin translation, not French. But he was known for poetry. Particularly, he wrote this cryptic form of poetry in the 1500s that got published and basically was viewed as being prophetic, and that he had this ability to foretell future events. So he basically was a fortune teller, right? That he could predict the future.
He actually appears on the face of
the
Inquirer and many others.
Oh yeah, to this day, that people will say he predicted Hitler, he predicted World War II, he predicted Hitler by name. Like there's all kind of stuff that's said about Nostradamus. Well, yeah. But he was very, you know, notable. Even in modern day, people still look to his writings, this cryptic poetry that supposedly predicts future events.
Was he a Christian?
No. So he was actually a mathematician and a physician. I think he was a doctor as well. Kind of a smart guy. But my point is that people, they will equate the two. Revelation and Nostradamus predicting the future. Revelation predicting the future. Don't do that. Revelation is not something to be decrypted to predict the future, right? It does portray and foretell future events, but we're not trying to sit down and decipher what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, and these cryptographic dates of putting numbers together and all of this stuff. Don't get caught up into that stuff.
I know personally, I came to the conclusion it can't be done. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for, you know, this is like the treasure map that you're going to understand, the timeline of the end time. It won't work.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. We talked about Nero, right? Nero was just catastrophic to the Christians. Nero. It's a Roman name, it's a Greek name. But if you were to translate Nero into Latin and then do some number mapping to his Latin name, Nero, his full name in Latin, would come out to the numeric 666. Well, if you take Jody and translate it into Arabic, and then do some number mapping to the Arabic system, you could come up with some. My point is, you could do whatever you want to make those numbers be whatever you want them to be. That's a falsehood. So don't get sucked into that stuff, that numerology stuff. Don't get sucked into that stuff. The full revelation of the opening of the seven seals begins here in chapter 6, verse 1. How many of you have heard the seven seals, the seven judgments of God? Right? That's where we are. And we're going to begin with White Horse, right? You know, so White Horse is going to kick us off as the first, seal, being broken here of the seven. Now, also, as we begin to crack open these seven seals here in chapter 1, chapter 6, verse 1, this will continue through chapter 8, verse 5. So there is a lot that happens between chapter 6, verse 1 and chapter 8, verse 5. We will get nowhere close to that in the next 5 minutes, right? But in these chapters, here's the things we're going to address. So this is my plug for you to be greatly encouraged to attend Sunday school, right, over the next year. Number one, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I'm going to start there today. Seals 1 through 4. Each seal, first four seals, four horsemen. We're going to talk about the dead saints under the altar. Seal number 5. We're going to talk about the great earthly catastrophes. What are things that happen in the end? Great catastrophes. Earthquakes. Fire, wars, rumors of wars, famine, right? We're going to talk about all these things. Sun, what's going to happen to the sun? It's going to turn black. What's going to happen to the moon? Moon turns to blood. Moon turns to blood, right? Yeah, blood moon. John Hagee freaks out, right? Yeah, he goes nuts. Yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. He rolled that bank account. Mm-hmm. Yeah, increase in the price of wheat. You know, stars falling from the sky. I think this was years ago. We had an Ask Anything conversation that actually kicked off the eschatology study. If I'm recalling correctly, I think it was Sister Nadine that submitted the question, who is the 144,000? Was that you, if I'm remembering right? And that who is the 144,000? And that kicked off a great discussion, you know, for the church to look into the scriptures, and that led us. And I said, you know what? This is a much broader conversation than can be had in a 1 hour breakdown. And so we went off into the eschatology study. But we will look at the 144,000. The 144,000 appears in this section of the seven seals, right? So we'll talk about that. And then there's the seventh seal, the final seal, the great silence in heaven, where everything just stops and there's absolute silence. You know, what has been going on in heaven in John's vision to this point? What's happening? If you still have your, if anybody still has their charts, you can look at that. You know, we have the what? There's people worshiping, singing. Who all is there? What all, you know, around, what's going on around the throne, right? Right around the instance of the Father. Past several weeks. But what's going on around the Father? How is the Father portrayed? Remember radiance of light? You know, around the throne? There was smoke, fire, thunder. All of this stuff is going on around the throne. So that's pretty loud, right? Right? And then you have four living creatures. And what are they saying? Holy, holy, holy. Right? I mean, they're proclaiming the holiness of God. And then you get out to the 24 elders, and the 24 elders are in agreement with the four living creatures. And when the four living creatures would submit, the elders would bow down, and they would cast their crowns, right, upon the glassy sea, right? So that's going on. Then behind the elders, what was behind the elders? Angels. How many angels? Six? Seven, a bunch, myriads of myriads, thousands upon thousands, and they're all glory to God, worthy is the Lamb. Right? So, I mean, this is and then when you get to the seventh seal, who's cracking the seals? The Lamb. But who was found worthy? The Lamb. The Lamb approaches the throne, the Lamb takes the scroll, and the Lamb begins to crack these things open. And when the Lamb gets to the seventh seal, there's silence in heaven. Imagine. Imagine all of this, you know, praise and brilliance and all of this stuff, and then now all of a sudden, silence. We won't talk about that. Right? It's exciting. So the seven judgments, and I am out of time. I still haven't got to the text. The seven judgments, we'll note that the seals are just the start. These seals are just the beginning of the judgments. There's actually three unique judgments that happen in Revelation. So of course, we have the seven seals that we're going to start with. How many of you have heard of the seven trumpets? The judgment of the seven trumpets. Right? And then, does anybody know the third judgment type that's in Revelation? The bowls, the pouring out of the bowls. Right? That's in Revelation chapter 16. So we have these three judgments with the seven seals, the seven trumpets, and the seven bowls. And we're going to see how does all this come together. And some view these judgments as a series. This is one of the things I think is a challenge, is they view these as a series of chronological events. That, it starts with seal number one, and then you work your way through seal number seven, and then the trumpets start, and then trumpet number one happens, and two, and three, and four, and five, six, seven. And then eventually, you get to the bowls, and now there's this third judgment that's coming upon the earth, and one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, right? And so you have all of this coming into play, but remember, we're dealing with what type of literature? Apocalyptic. Apocalyptic literature is not narrative. A narrative, you could take those things in chronological order. Say, well, we start here, we're telling the story, and it's playing out. Just like the Gospels. The Gospels are narratives. The beginning of Jesus' ministry, the end of Jesus' ministry, and everything in between, right? Here, people, if you view this as a narrative, you'll go, this is what's going to happen in the beginning, and by the time I get to chapter 20 and chapter 21, that's the end. It's not a narrative. It's apocalyptic. It's visionary, right? It's symbolic. So when we view this through John's apocalyptic lens, we actually begin to see that these judgments actually overlap themselves. This is where it gets very interesting. They seem to coincide with the same period of time, right? So this specific time is the same time throughout each of the judgments, which I fully believe embraces the beginning of Christ's, you know, first coming, and is this time period until his second coming. And so what we're seeing is the first coming, you know, Christ comes, lives, dies, buried, resurrected, ascends to the Father. What does John open his vision with? The slain Lamb in the throne room. The glory of the Lamb, the glory of the Father. He's ascended, he's risen, he's conquered, he's beat death, he's beat destruction. But, church, you're still on earth. And you're going through trials, and you're going through struggles, and you're going through turmoil. But in the end, Jesus wins. Jesus will destroy all things that are not of him. And you, church, in Christ, will be spared. And so these judgments, we kind of see, you know, regardless of however many there are, they happen in this time span of Jesus' first coming and the culmination of his second coming. Because at his coming, it's done. Like, it's over with, right? That's one of the things we have to look at, because this is where people get caught up in saying, well, there's going to be a rapture. Well, what is the rapture? Who knows what the rapture is? Take the whole church? Right? See, this is where you see the hesitation. Well, no, because some of them are left behind. Well, if you're left behind, are you part of the church? Or are you not part of the church? Well, it's for those that hadn't believed. So they're not part of the church. But Christ is absolutely clear, you know, and John is absolutely clear that all whom have been given to the Son by the Father, the Son will get, right? It's just, this is what it is. And there's nowhere, number one, the word rapture does not appear in the Scriptures anywhere. Yeah, well, that's getting into the peak of things, yeah, of dispensationalism. That's where that comes out of, is that dispensational thought process. And the 70s, late 70s, yeah. But you know, that whole process starts with John Darby. And how many of you heard of the C.I. Schofield, the Schofield Study Bible? If you have a grandmother, great-grandmother who was solid in Bible, or even a grandfather, I promise you they probably have somewhere sitting around their house a Schofield Study Bible. It was the first study Bible in print. And this rewinds back to these men were Schofield and Darby were 1800s. Getting into the early 1900s, you have the first time in history where notes, everybody knows what a study Bible is. It's a Bible that has notes in it, right? Yeah, commentary written in it, right? let's see, who's got it? So this, I'm using, you'll see in the margins, you see the scripture, it's got little numerics with scripture references, and you know, it may give you, hey, this word is actually, this is called a reference Bible. A reference Bible has references that point you to other scriptures. Sister, let me see, that's a study Bible. Yeah, so hold that up. So if you've got a Bible that's got a bunch of notes where somebody has given you explanations or commentary, that's a study Bible. That's a reference Bible, study Bible. Schofield, the Schofield Bible was the first Bible in print to have notes. That thing gets printed, and everybody's like, oh, this gives an explanation of Revelation. And Darby and Schofield were dispensationalists. They kind of pioneered this thought process in the 1800s. So everybody in the early 1900s, the only input they were getting and what they thought was valid, because by the way, it's printed in the Bible, right? So printed in the Bible, you got these notes. These notes are derived from Darby and Schofield. It's the Schofield Study Bible. So it's his commentary. So you're getting his perspective. That begins to permeate the United States because now it's mass production. And that becomes the major thought point by the time you get into the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. Hal Lindsey, late great Planet Earth, all of this stuff begins to come into play until we're modern day. You have multiple raptures. Jesus is coming back. Some people are going. Some people are left behind. Well, how many times does the scriptures reference Jesus' return?
Once.
Well, how do you get around that? Well, see, in the rapture, his feet are not going to... He's coming back in the clouds. So that's not really a coming back. So then you start dancing, right? You start dancing around the issue. And that presents a challenge. So as we progress through this, these judgments will seem to overlap and coincide. The seals, the trumpets, the bowls, right? And I want to give you a couple of references here. As we progress through these judgments, you'll note there is a common theme with each of the judgments. God is increasing his judgment upon Satan. He's increasing his judgment upon the great dragon, right? And as you see these judgments increased on the dragon, the beast, the false prophet, you know, all the henchmen, all the demons, all of those who follow Satan, God's judgment is increasing. It's getting worse. With each seal that's broken, with each trumpet that blows, with each bowl that's poured out, his wrath gets greater and greater and greater and greater. Now, when you got a wounded dog and you go up trying to get it, what's going to happen? He's even more fierce than he is when he's not injured. But now we're dealing with a wounded Satan. We're dealing with a wounded creature. And he is going to fight all the more. So the more God's judgments increase, the worse he gets. Right? That's kind of what we're seeing as all this kind of comes together. In each case, we see events leading to final destruction of Satan. Every circumstance, whether it's the trumpets, the seals, or the bowls, in the end, Satan's defeated, Jesus wins. Right? And all of the references. So we see this seems to correspond with all three major judgment themes, is that it's the period in between Christ's resurrection, the actual, you know, fulfillment of prophecy, his heel crushing the head of the serpent. Now you've got this wounded devil, this wounded Satan that eventually is going to be finally destroyed. But in the process of knowing he's getting destroyed, knowing he's getting beaten, he gets more and more and more angry and aggravated, and more assaults upon the church and more assaults upon the saints. Also, we see this growing pressure put on Satan, intensifying his responses. Then listen to this. In order to understand this pattern better, it's helpful if we turn to the Olivet Discourse in Matthew chapter 24. If you read Matthew chapter 24, you'll see this is kind of this is where the disciples look at Jesus. They're on Olivet. Does everybody know, how many of you have heard of Mount Olivet? The Mount of Olives, right? So let's put it on here. When you look at the Mount of Olives, right? Is the temple located in a valley? Is Jerusalem a city in the valley?
The mountain.
It's a city on the hill, right? It's the Temple Mount, right? So we have this mountain, Mount, that's the temple, right? And so we'll put the temple up here. And this is Jerusalem, yeah, Eastern Gate, right, on this side. Now, it goes down into this valley. It's called the Kidron, right? And then you come up, and over here, you have the Mount of Olives. Right? It's a hilly mountainside that has olive trees everywhere, particularly right at the base of this. It's Gethsemane. This is the garden. So when Jesus left, Jerusalem went out of the city and went with his disciples that night into the garden to pray. They went out of the city, went down into the Kidron, and went right up into the garden. Right? If you continue up the mountain of Olivet, you get to the top. That's where you can cross over, go into Bethany, other places. But him and his disciples, they didn't stay in the city overnight. If you remember the last days of Jesus, they would come into the city during the day. He would rebuke the Pharisees, cleanse the temple, all of that stuff would go on here. And then at night, they would leave. And they would go back out, stay outside the city. And then they would come back. Right? So they're on their way out. They're over on the Mount of Olives. How many of you have seen those pictures where you're looking across this kind of valley and you see the gold dome of, you know, which is a mosque nowadays, but you see the mosque, you see Jerusalem, the city, but you're looking at it across this valley? That is the view from the Mount of Olives, right? So you're looking at that. The disciples are looking at that in Jesus' day with the Lord sitting there, and they're all looking at this amazing city with the Temple Mount and all the structures, and they look at Jesus and say, when's the end going to happen? And Jesus says, I tell you this, there won't be one stone left on top of the other. And then he goes through this discourse of Matthew 24, and he tells them, in the end, this is what's going to go down. And then if you take that, what Jesus said, how it's going to play out, and then you look at the seven judgments in any form, whether it's the seals, the bowls, or the trumpets, they coincide. So they were talking about the same thing, the same period, the same understanding. And we don't have time, but we'll stop there. Next week, we'll jump into chapter 24 of Matthew, because I want to lay that out as a week after next. Yeah, I'm not here next week. Yeah. I'll be in the Napa Valley, not the Kidron Valley. So, yeah. So we'll lay out Matthew. So if you want to read Revelation, just continue to read Revelation as a whole, but then look at Matthew 24. And we'll look at those side by side, and then hopefully we'll get into White Horse. You know, we'll get to play his part, and we'll get to see Preston in action, you know, as White Horse. So, all right, let's pray. And Heavenly Father, thank you for the time. I know, Father, there's so much to cover in your glorious word, but I pray that in some way that